From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, September 1st, and a lot of what the legislature cooked up becomes law. We'll see what new laws impact women's health and how some new laws could make it even easier to open carry a gun in Texas. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Sunday, September 1st, over 800 new laws passed in the last legislative session go into effect. Some laws that were signed by Governor Greg Abbott went into effect immediately. Others were written to start with the new year 2020, but most will kick off on September the 1st. Many of these new laws are highly specific and detailed, impact targeted industries, but others are going to be game changers and will be felt by many in Texas. For example, hopefully there will be fewer stolen packages when left on porches. The so-called porch pirate law raises the penalty for nicking mail, packages, and postcards. It will now be a felony, and those caught and convicted could see some prison time. Texas is now the 19th state to raise the age limit to 18 to buy over-the-counter cough syrup. According to Stop Medicine Abuse, 1 in 30 teens has abused over-the-counter cough syrup to get high. And also starting September 1st, the age to buy and use tobacco products is raised from 18 to 21. There is an exception for those in the military. This is a Class C misdemeanor, comes with a fine of up to $500. At the Senate hearing on tobacco 21, 18-year-old high school student Kellen Crunk of Lufkin testified in favor of the bill.
As a senior who is 18 years old now, I look back at how it was when I was a freshman. The freshmen and sophomores look up to the seniors and they mirror and copy what they do. And that can be a good thing, but it can also be a really bad thing. And in the case of tobacco use, it's really bad. Because I am 18 years old, I can go out and legally buy tobacco and e-cigarettes. I can use the products and show them off on my Snapchat and Instagram, which influences the people who look up to me. Even worse, as an 18-year-old, I can buy those products and share them with my peers, even if it is illegal. Unfortunately, I see fellow classmates who are already addicted to nicotine. They think e-cigarettes and Juul are the cool thing to do because they believe that these products are just water vapor. They have no idea that they contain nicotine and other harmful substances like formaldehyde. And the reason my fellow students believe this partly isn't their fault. Big tobacco companies avidly market to the youth. Philip Morris Industries even said, and I quote, "Today's teenagers are tomorrow's potential customer." They introduce flavors like cotton candy and fruity pebbles, which are appealing to youth, and the youth get addicted. Students plug in their e-cigarettes to the school-provided laptops and hide the e-cigarettes in their jacket sleeves and then blow out the smoke into their backpack to hide it from teachers. I see too many students graduate with not only a high school degree, but also a degree in nicotine addiction. It's time for Texas to stand up to big tobacco.
Women's health care and reproductive rights were again a concern in the last legislative session. Sam Robles, Advocacy Director at Progress Texas, tells us that progressives were able to stop some harmful bills from being passed while also working towards some bipartisan bills that improved health care for women in Texas.
What we're going to be seeing going into effect on September 1st are a slate of reproductive health care bills that are focused on making sure that women who are incarcerated are getting equitable health care. And what we've been seeing and part of the work that we've been doing as Progress Texas and with additional reproductive advocates across the state is finding ways to push for legislation that speaks to the lives of Texans, from birth control to making really hard decisions for families when it's pregnancy or maybe end-of-life directives. And so what we've seen this year is an effort on both sides of the chamber, bipartisan, that is moving towards increasing the level of health care that women are receiving while incarcerated. We're also seeing protections for sexual assault survivors. And the state is now going to be tackling on how to study and really address postpartum depression for women in Texas.
Now, so House Bill 650 makes a series of changes to state law that are designed to make state prisons more accommodating to female inmates in regards to their health care. The bill bans the shackling of pregnant women during childbirth. And so that was a problem. It had been happening, and it was recognized and addressed in a bilateral way in the last legislative session. You see this as moving things in the right direction.
That's right. We're moving things in the right direction for Texas women, and in a way where each of us needs to access reproductive health care, and that comes at different parts in our lives, right? And the way we access it should not depend on our zip code or immigration status or if we're incarcerated or not. And so when we look at the anti-shackling efforts that have been underway by Representative Celia Israel and Republican Representative James White, I mean, this is what dignity looks like for women and reproductive health care here in Texas.
Now, also HB 253, that's the health care access for postpartum depression, but it also has been talked about as this five-year study we'll be looking at, hopefully trying to figure out why we have such high maternal mortality in Texas. Mm-hmm. And this is a major concern.
That's right. In Texas, we are seeing high rates of maternal mortality, and we see it in regards to Black women. And so there are a number of things that happen after pregnancy and leading up to pregnancy that we are not catching in our system, and that is leading to the deaths of mothers that should not be happening. And so as we look at maternal mortality and efforts to address postpartum depression, really what we're doing and what the state is responsible for is making sure that women who go through with pregnancy are able to come out of it and raise their families, and that we're making sure that there are no sort of racial bias, you know, discrepancies that are happening along the process.
So women having a safe birth experience, post-birth experience, reducing Texas maternal mortality, infant mortality, that should be something that everyone in Texas should agree that that needs to be a priority. Every woman in Texas needs to have total confidence that they're going to have a safe birth experience.
That is right. Every single woman in Texas should have should be able to plan for their families to go through the experience, have all the resources and support that they need to deliver and to create and to raise a family that's going to thrive here in Texas without having to worry about, will I be able to go to the doctor next month after Medicaid, after my Medicaid ends? You know, these aren't the sort of decisions that should be weighing down on women.
But there were other bills that are still, some people thought, made things difficult for agencies like Planned Parenthood. Senate Bill 22 goes into effect on September 1st, prohibits government entities from providing anything of value to an abortion clinic or an affiliate, even if money isn't explicitly for abortions or the clinic doesn't perform the procedure. Proponents of the law say it's an effort to protect taxpayers' funds from going to entities associated with abortions. And so people see this as actually hurting overall health care for women.
That's right. And while the state of Texas has made significant gains in making sure that women who are incarcerated or that we're making sure that we're addressing postpartum depression and maternal mortality, what we've seen this year is that the state of Texas has defunded local health care in a state where Texans do not have access to it, where we have the highest rate of children not being insured in Texas. And so this is really, you know, for the communities that are being served by Planned Parenthood and others across the state, these are clinics that they can access that are just down the street from where they live. Right. And these are clinics that they have been in those neighborhoods for so long, catering to the low income Black and brown women across the state. And I think that's a really, you know, it really shows where the state's priorities are when we're defunding local health care, but not making the gains to make sure that every single Texan has access to it.
Now, when a lot of these bills are passed and they become law, people need to know that that's now the law and what their rights are. And mm-hmm. We need to promote this new law. It's the right to pump breast milk. Starting Sunday, Texas law makes it clear that women can pump breast milk wherever they want. The previous law allowed breastfeeding wherever, but didn't specify pumping. We all know that breast milk is the best option for children to have a healthy first year of life. So this is something that we need to let people need to know so they can stand up for themselves.
Absolutely. And the right to be able to pump breast milk is such an important family right, and I think really falls a line in protecting pregnant women and women who have families. We know that they're along the different parts of hiring, of the hiring process or promotions, or even in the workplace, we see discrimination happening against mothers for all sorts of reasons. And for a woman to be able to raise her family and go to work and be able to not only perform in her job, but be able to provide the best sort of health for their baby is so important. And this is one that I think really shows where workplace justice has come a long way in coming together with reproductive health care.
And everyone should be an advocate for these reforms.
Absolutely. And I think what we're seeing happening in the state legislature is sort of a new turn. We have been under a state that has for a long time come out with a lot of anti-abortion, anti-women initiatives. And what we are seeing happening across the state following the abortion bans is that support for abortion access is only increasing. And a majority of Americans and Texans support access to abortion. And what we are hoping to see and what we will see is that abortion is going to become a key issue for voters in 2020. And we're going to start seeing the demographics and the ideologies of those that represent us in the Capitol change. And along with that change is going to come proactive legislation that really looks to repair the damage that has been done to our reproductive health care system.
Sam Robles is the Advocacy Director at Progress Texas. In the last legislative session, Texas lawmakers passed about 10 bills that make owning and open carrying a gun easier. But also, a law was passed that prevents convicted felons from getting a concealed carry license if they have misdemeanor convictions, pending criminal charges, chemical or alcohol addiction, or certain psychological diagnoses or restraining orders. But overall, Jill Switzer of Gun Sense Texas says most new gun laws in the state are not going to make Texas any safer.
You know, I thought maybe naively going into this legislative session with two massacres essentially in Texas, Sutherland Springs and Santa Fe happened between the 2017 session and the 2019 session. So I thought certainly some common sense, evidence-based policies will pass in a bipartisan way. So obviously myself and other advocates for safety worked hard on trying to make that happen. We were sort of confronted by a non-data-based idea that more guns make us safer. And the reason I say not data-based is because the data show no, that's not true. More guns don't make us safer. So that way of approaching gun violence, you know, like you say, manifested in some very unsafe and disappointing legislation.
We had these shootings, massacres, and the response at the legislature was more guns. There was SB 535. Which was passed and becomes law on September the 1st. It allows guns to be carried in churches, synagogues, and other established places of worship. However, established places of worship still may prohibit weapons on their premises. What are your concerns?
Here's the thing with that bill. When it was filed and first heard, it not only had the say in churches, places of worship have to post, but it also had some reductions of fines and some additions that, again, would have lowered penalties about carrying guns anyway. So that was taken off, and it became just what you said. Essentially, it says, like any private business, churches have to post if they don't want firearms. And the other thing that I was explaining to somebody yesterday is a lot of times bills taken in conjunction are even more troublesome. So as far as carrying firearms in churches, I hope churches find out at places of worship. I hope they find out soon that they have to post if they want to exclude, and we're going to be doing some outreach. People who belong to congregations should know and look for the signs and talk to their church leader and discuss what's the safest for their place of worship. There's two bills that are impact that are bad bills. One is House Bill 121 by Representative Swanson. And I call that bill the oops bill because it essentially says if you ignore the signs and you go in with a firearm and somebody in management at the place of business says, you know, we don't allow firearms here, and you leave immediately, which is not defined, it's all okay and there's no penalty. So that would be true for churches as places of worship as one example. And then there's another bill, Senate Bill 772 by Senator Hughes, that says essentially limits liability for entities that do not post. So it's an encouragement to not post to prohibit firearms. So that's those three bills taken together are even more problematic. One thing I should point out, though, is that after Sutherland Springs, the Attorney General issued an AG opinion that said places of worship have to post to keep guns out. So this was codifying what the Attorney General's opinion already said.
What about this, the idea that this is the solution to mass shootings in places of worship is making guns more easily available in these places?
The data show across the country in Texas that that's not the case, that more guns don't make us safer. And so there's no reason for me to expect that to be different for places of worship. You know, part of what the underlying assumption of allowing people to carry in any particular place is some kind of assumption that if someone's carrying, that they will necessarily identify the shooter, accurately shoot the shooter before they get shot. And and then when police respond, police will somehow know that you're not the shooter, that you're the, you know, bystander with a firearm. So all those generally are false assumptions. Even police in crisis incidents have less than 50% hit rate, and they're continuously trained. So that's one example of why the assumptions are incorrect.
Also, I mean, if a person is packing, if they come into the place of worship, an individual, and they're having, I would assume, probably a handgun, if they think they need that, they're bringing a handgun. A person who shows up to do a massacre, like at Sutherland Springs, they're wearing body armor. And they are probably going to have a long gun, semi-automatic, with high velocity, ammunition. In Sutherland Springs, the shooter, Devin Patrick Kelly, opened fire from the outside into the church first. There was no way anyone inside the church would have been able to respond to that. It just seems I fail to understand what the thinking is that is going to be the deterrent.
You know, I think some people think, but they don't know the data, they've got misinformation, or they somehow think, well, that won't be me. And, that's, again, false. And you're right. The difference in the ammunition, I have a handgun and you have an AR-15, is that's not going to, that's not an equal match. And a lot of people can die very quickly before I could, you know, get a shot at you. And then I'm unlikely to hit you.
Another law that goes into effect on September the 1st, dealing with firearms, landlords will not be able to ban renters from having guns in their apartments. And what is your response to that?
Yeah, it's, you know, the federal Heller decision said people can have firearms in their homes to protect themselves. So in some ways, I see that. I think if I were renting, that would really trouble me, because there's so many common areas and there's so many places that, you know, people making a mistake, which door is yours, which door is another. And I just see it as a really a huge problem.
Another law, school districts can no longer ban possession of firearms that are stored in locked vehicles. So these are vehicles that will be on school district property.
You know, whatever Texas Gun Sense, our approach to legislation is to try to make it better. So, you know, we suggested things like it has to be locked separate from ammunition in the trunk, or it's there are certain designated parking spots that are somehow protected, et cetera, et cetera. And but, you know, didn't happen that way. And it's such a problem, because theft of firearms from parked cars is a huge problem across Texas. And so persons will know, gee, this teacher is going to be in school all day, and here's their parking lot. It's just not a good idea.
Was there any law passed in the last legislative session dealing with firearms that made it restricted ownership in any way, or where they could carry them, or were they all towards making it easier to obtain and easier to carry?
So the biggest victory for gun violence prevention is there were bills. The bills didn't pass, but in the appropriation bill, there's a budget item for $1 million for DPS to do a safe storage campaign, so $1 million for the biennium. And we're talking with them and giving them some good information now. As far as other significant legislation that impacts, that has common sense, evidence-based policies, not exactly. There's a couple of domestic violence bills, House Bill 1528, Senate Bill 415 was pasted to that. And so, you know, firearms and domestic violence is a huge problem. So those are certainly victories, a little less on target for overall gun safety.
After the legislative session ended, we had the terrible shooting in El Paso, and then it seems like we had some sort of awakening from some of our lawmakers and leaders in regards to guns. Is that a temporary effect, or are you seeing actually some regret maybe that these laws are coming into effect? Would these same laws be passed today now after El Paso, or wouldn't have had any change at all?
So I guess your basic question is anything going to change because of the El Paso massacre? And this is my observation since that happened, is there's been press conferences, and there's domestic terrorism task force that the governor appointed. Then there's a roundtable August 22nd. And actually, Texas Gun Sense was the only gun violence prevention organization invited to be a part of that. And so Ed Scruggs, our board chair, was there. He said that there were essentially there were good discussions of some, you know, possibilities. But this is oversimplifying to say, but a law can't pass without the legislature in town. So we can have task force and roundtables and safety commissions, and there's not too much that can be done absent legislation. I'm hearing so far the governor's not willing to call a special session. That's a pretty clear message. We made some recommendations about if we're not going to have a legislative session, let's have the governor has a pot of grants that he can give. Often you hear about it in terms of criminal justice, and that's fine. I mean, there could be grants to communities to do important things like disarm abusers. But as far as maybe overturning some of this irresponsible legislation or create a new legislation, everybody knows you have to have the legislature in town. And mostly I hear in 2021 we'll do X. You know, unfortunately, this could happen again. So I've been in this position 2 years. There have been many mass shootings, three of the worst in Texas in 3 years. So it's hard for me to say what's going to push people, when's it going to be the limit, and there's still going to be the more guns make us safer, hopefully not as widespread. I'm not trying to sound so pessimistic. It sounds like I am. I wouldn't do this work if I didn't have some wild optimism hidden underneath. One thing whenever I talk to anybody, I like to remind folks that of the firearm deaths in Texas, more than 60% are suicide. So we've got to get our heads around suicide prevention, and the numbers are increasing. It's all about easy access to firearms, because in the case of El Paso, hate plus easy access to firearms is dangerous. Suicidal ideation or homicidal ideation plus easy access to firearms can be death. Same for domestic violence plus easy access. That kind of gets at the argument we hear sometimes. It's not guns who shoot people. That if you look at the equation, we need to work on both sides of the equation, but not ignore the easy access. And then the other bill that should keep us up nights is there's now no limit on the number of school marshals in schools that are allowed in schools. There used to be a ratio. We do not like the school marshal program anyway, but the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill to do away with the limits of how many firearms per student, essentially. School marshals, as you likely know, are armed adults, minimally trained, who have other jobs at the school, like teacher, custodian, administrator. I tell people all the time, even before this, that they have to vote in every election, no excuses. And so the elected school district board is the one who can decide on school marshals or not. So people need to be very active in their school district voting and talking to their school district elected representatives about that they don't want school marshal program.
Jill Switzer is the executive director of Texas Gun Sense. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page. That's at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters episodes to listen to. You can also find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.